So we've got just a wonderful panel here. It's quite a jet-setting panel. Maud Barlow flew in from Norway last night, and Bob Heidel, it says Henry on his badge, but he goes by Bob. He flies about 400 to 450,000 miles a year. And Marianne is always somewhere when I'm trying to reach her, even though she's in Chicago. So these are frequent flyers with the capital F that we have here. So
big carbon footprint.
Yeah, right. But let's start just with some quick introductions here, Maud. So national chairperson from the Council of Canadians. We don't have a organization like that in the United States. Tell us a little bit about the Council of Canadians.
Well, first of all, pleasure to be here, and hello, everybody. Council of Canadians is Canada's largest public advocacy organization. We're a citizens' movement. But rather than our members, we have about 80,000 members, but rather than our members kind of being passive and giving us money and then we do the social justice, environmental justice work, we train people to do it on the ground. And so we have 72 chapters across the country where activists learn to actually influence local policy. And our work is on resource issues, also social policy issues. We came into being in 1985 when Ronald Reagan and Brian Mulroney were planning the first free trade agreement in the world, which was the predecessor to NAFTA, because we were very concerned that unlimited free trade without regulation and investment without regulation would lead to environmental and social concerns, and we were right. But we've grown to have many, many issues. One arm of our organization is called the Blue Planet Project, and it works internationally for the right to water. And I'm also chair of the board of Food and Water Watch, which is a wonderful organization here in the United States fighting for equitable access to food and water and to stop corporate takeover of food and water. And I'd invite you to go to Food and Water Watch's website.
And just wrapped up a term as the UN Water Czar as well, didn't you?
Well, I was honored to be the first and only, to my knowledge, senior advisor on water to the 63rd president of the United Nations General Assembly in the past year. His term just finished. His name is Miguel Descoto Brockman. He's from Nicaragua. He's a liberation theologian priest, and he is a wonderful human being. And he and I started a process for an emergency resolution at the United Nations, because what stunned me when I got there was that although there's a lot of good work being done on water issues by the 24 agencies of the United Nations, there is no body in the General Assembly, no place for this information to go. There's a deep political disconnect at the United Nations. So we're preparing, and I'm now working with the G77 and some other countries to move this ahead for an emergency resolution that would basically say that there is a crisis in water, that it's, I believe, the greatest ecological and human crisis of our time, that it's getting worse, and that there is no body on Earth that is more or in any way comparably able to deal with it than the General Assembly. And so we're really hoping to get the political part, the wing, if you will, of the United Nations on board to deal with this crisis, which at the moment is not happening.
Great, thank you. And Marianne Dickinson, Executive Director from the Alliance for Water Efficiency, just down the road in Chicago. Tell us a little bit about that organization.
Well, the Alliance for Water Efficiency is actually a new stakeholder organization. It's about 2 years old now. And it is broad-based. It has water utilities, government agencies, plumbing and appliance manufacturers, the irrigation industry, the academic community, energy and environmental advocates, all sit together in a stakeholder board and work towards water efficiency policies in the United States and Canada. So we cover both countries. We are here in the Chicago, in the Great Lakes area, and we were invited to locate in Chicago because Mayor Daley specifically invited us to come to the Great Lakes and work with the Great Lakes on water efficiency issues and the water conservation issues in the compact. We spend a lot of time educating water utilities and stakeholders on wise water use. We have built a very detailed website, which I encourage you to go and look at. We just found out that we've gotten about 4.5 million hits on that site during 2009 so far this year. So it's obviously very well used. Lots of information on products and programs. And we are also working closely on policy issues in Washington, and we're beginning to think about how to grapple with the consumer issues, which we'll talk about a little bit later.
Great. Thank you, Marianne. And then Bob Heidel, chairman of the Heidel-Eister International Hydrogeologist. Bob, talk a little bit about the work you do.
Well, the firm is a founded in 1968 when I was 13 years old, and we emerged initially as a result of environmental planning and the lack of any environmental planners, and so we had a lot of physical disciplines in there, planners, geologists, microbiologists, and so forth, and did urban planning and open space and conservation planning, and that emerged into a whole other layer of activity surrounding water because my background is a hydrogeologist and economist. In the late 50s, early 60s, most people couldn't spell those words, but today they're very common. And we took over a major position in the consulting business. We're a private firm. Most of our clients, although we work for municipalities and public water supplies, a lot of our work and research is completed on behalf of the beverage and bottled water industry on a global scale. So that explains perhaps my mileage. But I'm one of about four people that have similar schedules in the firm. And it's been a lot of fun.
And you're also on the board of the International Bottle.
I'm on the board of directors. Well, I'm actually on the executive committee of the board of the International Bottled Water Association. I'm a former chairman of the International Council of Bottled Water Associations, and I sit on the board of an organization in Brussels that relates to distribution in the retail world.
Great. So the premise of the discussion today is that we're leaving the century of oil, and we're entering the century of water. That's not to say that in this century cars are going to be running on water, but that oil was the defining natural resource of the last 100 years, and that water will be the defining natural resource of the next 100 years. And so I've asked all our guests here today, given that, keeping that in mind, what two or three key issues should environmental journalists keep in mind as we continue to progress into the century of water? Maud, you want to start?
Shall I go up for
it? Your choice. Your right. choice.
I'll just come up here so that people can at the back can see. As I say, it's a delight to be here, and I'd like to also I'll congratulate my Canadian colleague, Andrew Nikiforuk, for winning the Rachel Carson Award. We're very honored and thrilled in Canada for this. And Peter, shall I answer the second question, too, while I'm here about the hot spots?
Yeah, sure. The second question is going to be, you know, what are going to be the key water hot spots in this century in North America and the world? Sure. Thank you, Maud.
All right, so for the three environmental issues that I think, or the three issues around water that I think environmental journalists should have in mind are the following. First of all, we hear a great deal about greenhouse gas emission-fueled climate change and the impact it's having on water. And, of course, it's absolutely true. With the melting of the glaciers, with the evaporation of our water systems, watersheds, taking place more quickly with global warming, with the ice packs, for instance, on the Great Lakes declining. Obviously, climate change has an enormous impact on our water. What I don't think we have understood or done nearly enough research or writing on is the opposite concept, and that is that our pollution, abuse, and most importantly, our displacement of water from where it's needed and where we can get at it ecologically and for our use is actually a cause of climate change. I don't think this is going to be discussed at Copenhagen, although a lot of us have tried very hard to do this. But let me briefly explain what I mean. I'm working with scientists who are actually able to quantify to some extent that when we take water from watersheds, rivers, aquifers, and so on, and then we use it to grow food in the desert where it's really not sustainable and where you end up creating two deserts, or when we move water from aquifers and watersheds through great big cities, and if those cities are anywhere near the ocean, they see that water as garbage and dump it in the ocean when they're finished. This is actually changing the hydrologic cycle over land, and we're actually creating deserts because of our moving water around the world the way we move oil.
and this is becoming a very major trend. I'm working with scientists in Slovakia who estimate that we're taking about 170 trillion liters of water a year from land-based water systems. This isn't water that would ordinarily be running into the ocean, and moving it through our cities into the ocean, not returning it. And I'm working with some very exciting projects and can talk to anybody about this, about stormwater catchment, rainwater catchment, recycling that takes this water, puts it back into the ecosystem. But the notion of the protection of water and ecosystems as an antidote and as part of the solution to climate change is very, very important, and I would urge you to start looking at that. The second answer to the three things environmentalists should keep in mind is that I think it's very important for us to put the ecological and human crisis together when we look at writing about, thinking about, wanting to make solutions to the global water crisis, because we have an ecological and human crisis together. And I think when we tend to have our environmental journalists, scientific journalists, and so on, who are writing about the actual ecological crisis, and then we have other folks, other journalists and other writers writing about the development crisis, the human rights crisis, the fact that more children die of waterborne disease every day than the next three killers put together, HIV, AIDS, war, and malaria put together. Water is the killer. And in almost every case, if the parents had had money, those children would not have died. So the crisis of water is the face of the greatest crisis of lack of equality in our world. It is the image, if you will, of inequality. And we're not going to get anywhere if we don't deal with these together. We are building a global water justice movement based on the twin foundations of ecological protection, ecological sustainability for water, and water justice. And I really would urge environmental journalists to take a look at this together. When you have massive poverty, especially in the big urban, peri-urban centers in the third world, it's almost impossible to keep the water clean because of the abuse of the water systems that are taking place in poor countries. Similarly, we can talk all we want, and I talk a lot about the right to water. We can talk all we want about the right to water. There's no right to water if we run out. And we are pumping our groundwater around the world at a furious rate. And I worry about the Millennium Goal on water at the United Nations is to cut the number of people without access to water right now in half by 2015. Not only are we not meeting that goal, but it's all about building pipes and pumping more groundwater. You get a country like India that's got 24 million bore wells going 24/7, and they just keep going deeper and deeper and deeper until they run out. Building more pipes for more groundwater is not the answer. The third concept that I would, or way to look at this issue that I would urge you to consider, is the issue around conflicts. There are many, many conflicts around water, one of them being between superpowers who are now going outside their borders to seek water security supplies, the way they have sought security supplies for energy and so on. There are conflicts between the needs of big cities and rural indigenous communities, conflicts between rich and poor. But one of the most important conflicts, and one that I would urge you to do more digging about, is this question about allocation. Who is deciding control of water? Who is making the decisions about who should have access to water? The most intense conflict now in the world around water is whether it is a commodity to be put on the open market for sale to the highest bidder, to be put on the stock exchange, and there are dozens now of indexes on water alone on the stock exchange. Countries like Australia, Chile, Spain are all getting into water markets where they actually see water as a property and allow that to take place. We actually have countries of the global north plus China and India buying huge tracts of land in Africa and other poorer countries. You even get poor countries buying tracts of land in poorer countries to own the water and actually taking out water rights. So this question of whether water is a property and a commodity is going to be a very important question in the next few years. If we had all the water in the world, it wouldn't matter. I wouldn't care. But we don't. And I, of course, am on a side, you might guess, that believes that water is a public trust. It's part of our common heritage. It is a fundamental human right. It belongs to other species. It belongs to the future. And that no one has the right to appropriate it for personal profit while others are dying from a lack of ability to pay for it. And what the work that we're doing at the UN and that we're doing in many communities around the world and actually in countries, when I came from Norway, I live in Canada, but we were celebrating something called Blue October. And we celebrate that in our water justice movement because in October, 4 years ago, the country of Uruguay had an election and there was a referendum that had come from a citizen-based plebiscite saying that not only is water a human right, but a public trust, and forced the government to change its constitution to declare it a public trust and a human right, which many jurisdictions are doing around the world. I had the honor on Earth Day of speaking to the General Assembly and putting my proposals of a global plan based on watershed protection and regeneration on one hand, water as a public trust as a second principle, and water as a fundamental human right as a third. But this question around who makes decisions around water is very important. And by the way, that doesn't mean I believe that water should be a free-for-all. We need absolutely strict controls around water and access to water and abuse of water. Martin Luther King said, legislation may not change the heart, but it will restrain the heartless.
Ah.
On the second question of where are the hot spots, there are so many. And one of the things I want to say to you is that when you hear the word drought, please go deeper, because drought often means the end of water. It's written as if it's cyclical drought, but it's actually an over... extraction of water leading to fundamental running out. One hot spot is going to be China and India. China is building a series of dams and a major pipeline to take the water from the Himalayas that now feeds all of the major rivers of Asia. India is very worried about this, and the double whammy, of course, is those glaciers are going to melt. And we are going to see huge conflict plus, I think, a huge number of deaths in that area as that water dries up. And the crisis right now is very intense in Mumbai in India, as they've gone deep, deep, deep into the groundwater, and it simply isn't there anymore. We're going to see and are seeing already huge conflicts in Africa. There are 22 countries in Africa in water crisis now. The predictions are that two-thirds of the people of Africa within 10 to 15 years will not have adequate access to water. Every single one of the 677 lakes there is in some serious form of decline, pollution, or absolute depletion. And again, we have countries and companies coming in and pulling up that water. We need I should have said this as a fourth concept to be keeping in mind, and that's the notion of virtual water. And that's where a country or a community uses water to grow something or produce something that then it extends, it exports. The United States exports about a third of its daily water use in the form of virtual commodity trading every day out of watersheds, out of the country. It's one of the reasons California is in trouble. And we don't know this. It's not part of our calculation. What many countries are doing, that they look good, Europe always looks good because it's got a lot of environmental laws in place, but they bring their water, they import their water footprint. So Great Britain imports two-thirds of its water needs through products that it imports. For instance, it grows all the roses that it sells around from Lake Naivasha, which is the beautiful lake in the Rift Valley in Kenya, where Out of Africa was filmed, and where that lake is going to be dead in 5 to 10 years if the current level of extraction keeps going. Australia's in crisis. I've been to Australia 6 times now in the last few years. I'm very, very committed to that country. I've fallen in love with it. And what happened basically is that they have extracted the Murray Darling. They've only got 2 big sources of water, an aquifer that's being depleted and the Murray Darling. They've extracted the Murray Darling so much all the way down the line that there is no water now left to run into the ocean in South Australia. They are physically, literally out. The water is receding. You can almost watch it. And salt water is invading, destroying the Murray Darling from the mouth up. This is all in the name of export, virtual water export, cotton, rice. 2 years ago, their rice exports dropped 100%, 98%, because they slammed into the water wall. And if I were a rice farmer there, I'd be real annoyed that my government didn't tell me this was coming. So Australia is a country running out of water. The United States, the Southwest, Florida has more than 1,000 people a day moving into it, big sinkholes opening up because they're pulling up the water so fast. We are depleting the Great Lakes. The extraction is greater than the return of flow. And I'm sure Andrew talked about the tar sands, so I won't, but it is a deep trouble spot. I'll end the opening comments by saying that I believe that the global water crisis, more than the energy crisis, more than the food crisis, or put another way, water is the food crisis, is going to slam us into the reality that the policies of unlimited growth, economic globalization, and the continued notion that we can still have more and more and more stuff, and somehow the planet will keep going, is just going to prove us wrong. Water is going to be the teacher, and the question is going to be whether we are going to listen. A colleague of mine calls it deglobalization. Doesn't mean there won't be markets. It doesn't mean there won't be trade. It does mean that we're going to have to look at issues like if something can be grown or produced closer to home, how do we have policies that support it? What do we do about these international trade agreements that continue to pull down regulations, local, municipal, state, federal regulations to protect the environment, to protect local health and safety? We are going to have to ask some very, very tough questions because this global water crisis is coming upon us. I don't care where you live. It might come upon you as in terms of the refugees coming into your community or your country because you still have water. But the world is going to change very quickly over this water crisis. And I'll just end by saying that I worry greatly that the water crisis is going to be a tremendous conflict. But I also have in mind the comet movies, you know, the Hollywood comet movies where there's a comet coming to the Earth and all of a sudden all of our differences don't mean anything because in 72 hours the Earth will end or whatever. So they send Tom Cruise up to blow it up, and I always think, leave him up there, take the family. No, I don't. A few other people I'd send up in that spaceship. Well, we have a comet. It's called the global water crisis. And it's either going to be the source of conflict for us, human to human, human to animal, a human species to the earth, and I'm working with people in the Middle East who are developing this concept of environmental peacekeeping, where water, in fact, could be just the opposite. It could be the gift from nature to teach us how to live with one another with more dignity and in more compassion and more equitably and live more lightly on our wonderful Earth. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Maude. Marianne, you want to take on the same questions? And if it seemed like Maude jammed a lot into 7 minutes, she did, but it was actually 14. So let's try and stick to our 7 minute time allotment there.
Okay. I will do my best to stay on time. Thank you for inviting me and for being here. I'm thrilled to be addressing this group. And so the 2 to 3 things that I would like to share with you, my views on the items that you need to know as you cover this water issue, is more at the consumption level. Maude was giving you a great overview of the supply issues and the available water resource issues around the world. But there are basically 3 things I'd like to leave with you in terms of what about at the consumption end, particularly here in the United States and Canada as well. First of all, our view of water and how it's used needs to change. We have grown up in a society where water is perceived to be free and universally abundant and unlimited. And it has not ever been considered as part of a sustainable resource equation, particularly from the consumer's point of view. And that world view of water has to change. We have to change how we're developing. New development, unless it's green, unless it's LEED certified or part of a green building program, new development has been shown in studies to actually use more water than their existing housing counterparts in their communities for a whole series of reasons having to do with excessive water use, particularly in the outdoor environment. And we're growing in the wrong places. We have all of these states, and Maude mentioned them, California, Texas, Florida, states where there's serious water crises, but those are precisely the states where population growth is the highest. California is going to have 52% more people in 2020 than it had in the year 2000. Florida is going to have 36% more people. These are states with already current water crises. So what that means is we have to adopt a view where we need to be much more efficient with the water that we use. Maud mentioned Australia. They have their residents in Australia use on average about 36 gallons per person per day on a residential basis. Our number in the United States is anywhere between 100 and 250. So Western lifestyle in Australia doesn't look that different to me. What are they doing differently? They're more efficient. They don't irrigate with potable water. They don't use potable water for non-potable purposes as we do here in the United States. So there are a lot of things that we need to do. We need to view water as an embedded energy source. In California, they did quite a bit of work showing how much energy was actually embedded in the water that was delivered for drinking and then treated as wastewater. 19% of the state's electric energy load is related to just the movement and the treatment of that water. And a third of their gas load is related to the heating of that water. So if you want to save greenhouse gas emissions, you can save water, and that productive relationship needs to be better explored. So that's one point. Second point is, in order to get to that view, we have to get through the barrier of our current government and water utility community that still perceives that they have a duty to serve the customer as much as the customer wants, and that duty does not involve telling the customer that the customer needs to use less. And we price the water so that it encourages the customer to use more. We still have in this country a third of the rate structures are declining block rate structures, which means the more you use, the cheaper it gets. We have to fix this problem. We have to make sure that the utilities don't lose money if they do water conservation, and that's the first thing they all tell you. Can't do water conservation, I won't make my basic bill charges. Because, why is that? Because the customers don't want the water to be the true value that it is. They want it to be as cheap as possible, because after all, it's free, isn't it? It just comes from the sky. All we should pay for is the piping of it to our houses. We have a serious problem there. And the utilities, even when they see that they can save millions of dollars in infrastructure costs by reducing their demand, they still don't have the upfront capital in order to fund those efficiency programs. So these are policy issues that we're working on to try and fix in Washington. For the first time in 20 years, there are 18 bills now before Congress on water efficiency and incentives and tax credits for water efficiency programs. So it's coming. This tipping point is coming. So the third point that I wanted to leave with you is, and here's where we're going to need your help. It's a serious barrier to getting this view of water to change, and that is the consumer. The consumer has absolutely no earthly idea how much water they use. In Oakland, they did an on-the-street survey, asked the customer, the average person on the street, how much water do you think your house uses? Answer was roughly 25 gallons per house per day. When told that the number was five times that, they said, oh, no, 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 we don't use that much water. But my neighbor, no, he does. Fundamentally, the consumer has no idea that most of the water that they pay for is actually going out on the lawn, that is the highest water use. Anywhere between 30 and 80% of residential water use is going out on the landscape. That's potable water treated to potable, reverse osmosis, drinking water standards going out on the lawn. Why we don't do gray water and a lot more sustainable, potable, non-potable water capture, like rainwater capture, like they do in Australia, is a matter of a lack of a federal policy. Because right now we are actively discouraging those kinds of collection options. So we need to get the consumer to think about being part of that partnership and reducing their water use, to get them down to what they're doing in Australia, more like that 13 gallons per person per day. The UN says it really needs to only be about 13 gallons. So our excessive water use in the U.S. and Canada leads the world in waste. And, you know, that's part of what we need to fix. So we need your help. The only place the consumer hears about any of these issues is from you. There is no national media campaign, as there has been for years, on energy efficiency or on recycling and waste reduction. Water has not been on the national media agenda in terms of a campaign to convince the consumer. So that's something that the Alliance for Water Efficiency is hoping to work on. It's going to need a lot of help and support for that. So in terms of hot spots, water hot spots, Maud, I think, gave you a good overview of the rest of the world, so I probably won't spend any time there, except that I'd like to add the Middle East to that. I think there's going to be exceedingly greater conflicts over water in the Middle East because the treaties don't necessarily deal with what the current consumption patterns are. She mentioned China, India, Australia, Africa. But let's just talk about the United States and Canada. We are perceived as the most water-abundant nations in the world, and we are. But if you take a look at the data shows that we're running out of water in some very key places, not just the arid southwestern states, you know, the California, Texas, Nevada, Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado. You expect that. You expect maybe Florida and Georgia. We've heard about them. But we're finding water shortages, localized water shortages, in just about every state in the nation. And even a documented study from EPA shows that 36 of 50 states will be experiencing freshwater shortages in the next 4 years. And four states didn't even respond to the survey, and they were California, Nevada, Arizona, New Mexico. So that's 40 as far as I'm concerned. 40 of the 50 states are going to be in shortage, right, in the next 4 years. They were too busy dealing with their drought to respond to the survey. So the pressure of where that water is going to come from all these states leads back to where we are here in the Great Lakes. The Great Lakes are perceived as this wonderful source of fresh water. And so even those areas where water is appearing to be abundant are going to become water conflict areas between the have-nots of the arid Southwest and the perceived haves here in the Midwest. And it's not going to be pretty. So how we deal with this will depend, I think, entirely on how efficient we can get our individual consumers to be. Because if we can reduce water use by 30 to 60%, and I think we can, a lot of those conflicts over water supply can be greatly lessened. So just want to finish by giving you a little pitch for the Alliance for Water Efficiency. I brought some information with me, and I'd be happy to stay afterwards and pass it out to you and encourage you to go visit our website. We have thousands of pages and documents that hopefully will be of interest to you if you get interested in the water topic. Thank you.
Thank you, Marianne. Bob, you want to round out the panel here on the opening remarks, please? Thank you.
I'd love to tell you how glad I am to be here with you, but I only have 7 minutes to do 50 years of my life, so we'll get drunk and disorderly later and break up the crockery and we'll be all set. By the way, both the prior speakers reminded me of something. If you have not read The Cadillac Desert, it's an old book. If you've read it, reread it. It explains policy formation in most of the world, even though it took place in the U.S. The discovery of preparing for this speech was that I had my first job in water 50 years ago last month, and I am fundamentally not happy about that, but I'll have to live through it. I was hired as a naturalist for the Brandywine Watershed Association of Southeastern Pennsylvania, which was the first private watershed association in the United States to clean up water. And it was a logical place to have it happen because the Brandywine goes over the fall zone of the Appalachian Plateau and the coastal plain of the east coast of the United States, and it supported all of the industry that emerged, such as DuPont, Downingtown Paper, Luke and Steel. It was all along that stream because of the fall zone and the power that it generated. And it's now, I can say, 50 years later, a clean stream. So there can be successes. Subsequent to that job, I studied under John Gottman, who is the author of Megalopolis. If you have not read that book, it will take you about a year, but I would suggest that you do it. It really set the stage for this century. And then I studied under a gentleman named Buckminster Fuller. And, well, everybody does that. I am still not sure what he was talking about. So I stand here before you today, 50 years after starting this voyage, and I can tell you that I have had the best life of any human being even though I put a lot of miles on, that anybody could want. This industry, this business, and my science as a hydrogeologist and economist, I was also trained as a constitutional attorney, never practiced because I became frustrated, because regulations today do not address what we're facing as a world, not as a nation, as a world. I gave a speech last fall at the UN, and it was on water policy, and specifically on boundary waters, which is the ultimate crisis. And I reviewed the evolution of the ILC, the International Law Commission's boundary water regulation. And I became so discouraged because it took 20 years to get a useless document printed and put together and executed. We look backwards for our case law. Do you understand that? Every law, every lawsuit that you see in the world is looking backwards to existing case law. Well, when you do that with the environment, and when you do that with international trade, and when you do that with a whole set of social conventions, you're going in the wrong direction. The things we face today, you cannot look backwards to go forward. We have to change how we think about things. And my two predecessors here have identified the crises we face. Those are crises we've never faced before. There is no precedent. There's no precedent in government, and there is no precedent in social convention that allow you to address these looking backwards. You know, Fuller gave me some advice one day. He walked into the office, and I was a graduate student, and I'm sitting there slaving over a Burroughs calculator, and I think most of you in this room aren't old enough to know what a Burroughs calculator was, but it was the kind of calculator you punched in the numbers, then you hit that final button that said go, and then you went out, got a cup of coffee, said good morning to your wife, walked back, and just as you walk in the door, this incredible rattling and shaking stops, and you have the wrong answer. Because I was never good with numbers. So one morning he walks in and he says, look, Heidel, what are you working so hard on? I said, Mr. Fuller, I'm trying to get these numbers sorted out. Just too many details. He said, look, forget the details. If you do not know what the big picture is, you're never going to understand the relevance or implications of the details. Now, that has made life for our staff at Heidel Eister hell. Because all I want to know is what the big picture is. You guys earn your living doing the details. In Peter's questions, he asked three questions. The first was, as we leave the century of oil and enter the century of water, what are the two or top issues that environmental journalists should keep in mind? The second was, what are going to be the top trouble spots in the next 50 to 100 years? Now, I have a problem with that question because I'm going to be 100 years old in 30 years. I don't even care how long my shingles last on the roof of my house anymore. But we have to look way beyond there. Your thinking has to take another dimension that you don't even know about, and it's called pushing the envelope. And so when I tell you, you have to become creative in how you look at things and how you position things in the matters about which you write. Go beyond the known. It is possible. Buckminster Fuller did it, and I'm still here now, still an advocate of what he talked about. John Gottman did it, and he forecast this century like that. So you can do it, and you can see beyond the known. And I think as journalists, you don't have an obligation, but it will make your life very interesting. Also, the lawsuit should be interesting. My answers to the two questions are, for environmental journalists, I offer the following comment, and forgive me for reading because otherwise I'll take a month. I've read many commentaries on environmental issues written by environmental journalists. These commentaries include articles of fact or just musings, which undertake such subjects as global warming, carbon footprints, the future of society, health impacts, water resources, bottled water, tap water, recycling, and so forth. There's been an extremely conflicted in the reporting in both the science and the implications. The consumer is becoming distrustful, and you can feel it. You can feel it in the questions asked, and they don't trust government now. So who are they to trust? You're the bastion of information. You must do something that wasn't done, and we're going to discuss in a minute. Although every journalist has a point of view, often that point of view is based on their experience in the Western world and is very generally Western-centric. Makes sense? In this respect, much of the reporting I have read has little significance to the majority of the world's population. I've been living in Bombay, India, by the way, since 2006. Some of what Maud has said is so. When I left at the end of September to come back here for a few weeks, because I actually do have a family, I actually have children. There's a question about that. this marriage will last indefinitely. There was 28 days of water left in the city of Bombay. 28 days. Now, the unofficial count of the population of Bombay is 18 million. We estimate there's about 25 million on 28 days. They get water 2 hours a week, 2 hours a day, and everybody runs and fills up. You know, it's a real dance. And then they draw off of their tanks that they've filled up. They have to boil it because the distribution system looks more like a sieve than a pipeline. And it is so highly contaminated, you need to filter it with first a chicken wire, and then you go down to something like a 2-micron filter. That's today. That's now. That's the world. There are 1.2 billion people in India, in an area less than the size east of the Mississippi of the U.S. That population has a 31% under the age of 15. 63.5% of that population is between 15 and 64, with the younger side being dramatically the major component of that. Its growth rate in 2009 was 1.5%. It's like a glacier. It is coming down on the landscape. Only it's not cold, and it's very human. China has a population of 1.4 billion in an area somewhat smaller than the United States. And between only these two countries, you have approximately 2.5 billion people in an area slightly larger than the U.S. alone. In the U.S., we have 300 million people. And we're sitting here deeply concerned about our environment. If we add Canada's 340, if we add Mexico, it's about 440. Under a half a billion people. Under the middle class that is emerging in India. With the same aspirations we've had as a nation since the 40s. Of what we want and what we believe we want. And the excesses that we may believe we are due. So when you write about environmental issues, remember that the Western-centric view is almost meaningless to the balance of the world's population. And I ask for a broader approach from you so that you can give relevance to what we are driving at here in the United States and the Western world as we know it.
That might be pretty close to a good time to end it, Bob. We're getting way over time.
All right, here. I'll give you just three things.
All right,
one,
thanks.
Three issues: the sovereignty of nations, civil order, and access to water. Those are the three looming issues. I don't identify the region, but those are the three. And sovereignty of nations and civil order are what you're facing. And if you want to talk to about climate with me sometime, I'm glad to do it. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Bob. Yeah. So this is the time for questions from the audience. So I think everyone knows the rules now, but go ahead and step up to a mic. SEJ members first. And Jamie, you want to ask the first question? Please state your name and your affiliation.
Is this working? Jamie Workman, author of Heart of Dryness, and it's mostly for Maud. The book tells a story about the Bushmen of the Kalahari and how for 30,000 years they've adapted to water scarcity and drought and climate change, and goes out of the Western model, looking back. But my question is, the more I got to understand them over 7 years, the more I realized they don't have a public trust doctrine. They truck, barter, and exchange. Water for them is a property right. They own water resources. They don't believe the UN can help them. Species don't have a right to water. And they wanted secure contracts with foreign entities. Their fear wasn't the public trust in the government. Their fear was the public trust and the government. And so how do you reconcile speaking on behalf of indigenous people when they contradict everything you're arguing?
Well, I think we can give different examples. I work with other indigenous communities around the world who have a very different view. I'm not suggesting that from above the UN is going to come and descend and tell people how to run their water systems. One of the principles that we advocate is local control of water and respecting local historical ways of dealing with water. If that's how that people has maintained its water, nobody's going to impose that on them. Most of the world, however, is not living in that kind of situation. Most places in the world are where there have been indigenous communities are being overrun by development, and that's the truth in India. That's the truth in many parts of the world. What we're talking about is recognizing the inherent right to water, the dignity of the right of all peoples to water, not some kind of gift from above, but the recognition that it exists. And when you barter on a small basis, and that's the agreement that you've always had, that's one thing. When you're talking about a company like Veolia or Suez coming into your community, getting a contract with your government because the World Bank said that that's how it's going to happen, they set up a system that both denies the local history and tradition, brings in a sophisticated Western pipe system, which may not be appropriate technology for the people there, and then denies anybody who can't pay for it any access to water because they've taken their water source. That's imposing the worst of the West and the worst of our views. So, I mean, in the limited time we have, even though I went over, of course we talk about local respect for local indigenous and local historical ways of dealing with water. If the public trust for them is based on a system where they have traditionally managed water, like the Sequoia program in New Mexico, of course we would never interfere with that. But we're talking now about big systems mostly, and most of the world is now urbanized, and as we move into the next 10, 20 years, we're moving to two-thirds of the world being urbanized. We have to come up with some fundamental principles for water. And you know, hearing us here, you might not think there are differences, but I'm very clear differences here between us around, for instance, something like bottled water, where you have, if you have the public trust doctrine, then you're going to work to having public water for everyone, not private water in a plastic bottle for only those who can afford it.
Jeff?
Jeff Burnside with NBC TV in Miami. Thank you for being here. Three terrific opening remarks. It seems to me, though, that the issue isn't that there's not enough water in the world, it's that there's too many people in the world. I'm sure you've heard this many, many times. And even if you were wildly successful, isn't it simply buying time? Isn't the real issue population?
That's actually a terrifying question.
Yeah.
I would say this. There's some things I didn't say that I can say right now in response to that issue. It is not that we don't have enough water to support the 6.8 billion people in the world. It is the location of the water, as you know. Maud and I probably differ on opinions about the nature of bottled water, but I happen to look at bottled water as the next cell phone. Because most nations emerging in an economy today can't put in the types of infrastructure that you're used to in Western Europe and here. They don't have the resources. And the population is urbanizing so rapidly that you can't lay the copper wire, so to speak, for the cell phone aspect of it fast enough. You can't build the infrastructure. It took 100 years to build this infrastructure in America, and now it's deteriorating. We lose 18%, or about 345 billion gallons a month in America through our public water distribution system. I can give you the actual figure if I looked at my notes, but it's an order of that. That means that in the total bottled water industry in America uses less than a month's worth of lost water in the public distribution system. And most emerging countries, and I've lived in Southeast Asia, Argentina, São Paulo, Brazil, Lusaka, Zambia, Ethiopia, and the Middle East for the last 50 years through the course of my life. And what I've seen is the inability to respond to the need for water. But when you add to that the whole issue of the climate change and the migrations that's going to cause, that's where that question becomes terrifying. Because Mod's sort of hit on that. I wish he had spent more time on it. Because at the end of the day, friends, we will have no control over the migration of people. And we will have no control over the conventional sovereignty of nations. And that is where what we face in the next, I will give it 500 to 1,000 years is what we're going to face. I'm not saying 100. That's not long enough. But our institutions take, the Parliament of Iceland is just 1,000 years old. Think about it. You can think 1,000 years ahead. And we need to.
And Maud, what do you think of that question?
Well, my colleague would like to speak too, but I want to say, and I think it's a combination of population and lifestyle. I remember being at an outdoor conference protest / right across from the Coca-Cola factory fortress in Plachamada in Kerala, India, and they fed 600 or 700 of us with no garbage. All the food was on leaves that just got thrown into the forest after. The water was all beautiful water that had been carefully nurtured there in clay cups. There was no waste. You have more waste from one takeout meal for one small family than we had that day with 700 people. So it is not the numbers of people per se. It's the way we live. And if the world, as David Suzuki says, everyone were to live the way we live in North America, we'd need four more planets. And that's why I ended my talk with this notion that we have got to challenge globalization, the notion of more and more stuff. It's why I'm so concerned about bottled water. We put something like 250 billion liters of water in plastic around the world last year. Only 5% of that got recycled. The vast majority ends up either in the ocean in those gyres of plastic or in our dump sites and leaches into the ground. It takes 500 to 1,000 years for that to break down. We have to be able to, if we're going to use technology, it's got to be a technology that's different. Yes, population's a concern, but in and of itself, it's not about population. It's about the way we live and the way we're going to have to change our lives.
Mary Ann, you want to say?
I'd just like to say just a few more words about that. I completely agree with what Ma just said. I think it is a matter of how we are actually promulgating our Western lifestyle and consumption patterns around the world. But also we need to focus on reusing that water. We can do a whole lot more to supply many more people around the world if we develop more sophisticated forms of collecting and reusing that water, especially for non-potable purposes. So if we're just talking about the potable water component that's necessary, that the UN says is 13 gallons per person around the world, we have enough water for that. But that's not where we're using it. We're using it for all kinds of consumptive purposes that are profligate. So if we could pull down and be more efficient with that, I think we would go a long way toward that social issue that you're raising.
Great, thank you. Is that Wendy? I can't see. Yeah, Wendy.
Hi, I'm Wendy Riedahl, University of Colorado and freelancer. And I have a question for Bob, but I'd be interested in your input as well. Wondering what essential tenets should a non-Western-centric view of water include?
I think there, I think it was just answered in part, the reuse. One of the things that amazes me about India is there is absolutely no waste in India. And it's not because they're eating on leaves. It's because everything that is thrown away, you have an economy with massive poverty. Everything that is thrown away is gathered up by the street people, and they use it to barter, to make money. So the plastic's recycled, wood's recycled, everything is recycled. And although it's one of the dirtiest countries you can travel in, that dirt has value and people are recycling it, even at the lowest economic levels of existence. And if you use recycling as one of the principal tenets, the recovery of the resource, we have just discharged it. We've never recovered it. And if you use recovery of the resource, you will pick up probably 50%. But our government policies, our government processes have not encouraged that. If a plumbing inspector came into my house in Hingham, Massachusetts, I would be arrested and thrown in jail because I have violated one of the key tenets of state environmental regulations. You cannot dispose of gray water except in a public water, wastewater system. And I think that is one of the dumbest, most archaic approaches to recycling you could ever have, and it is destroying our resources.
Just an
addendum comment to that. The Western view that we have that we need to change is that we need to build large water facilities, storage reservoirs, big wells, collect water, pipe it to customers, collect it back, treat it, and then discharge it, usually to an ocean where it can't be recovered, as Maud mentions, into the hydrological cycle. We're trying to export that model around the world, where really, from a sustainability climate change perspective, we should be doing on-site systems that serve very small communities and are self-sufficient, and where the water is reused over and over again. That would be my answer to that, how you de-westernize the view.
Yeah, I deeply agree with that. I talk about the three Ds, dams, desalination, and diversion. I think we in the global north or the west have this notion that technology will save us. No matter what we do or what we run out of, technology is going to fix it. And I can assure you, dams, diversion, and desalination are not the answer for us, but we are exporting that concept around the world, and it is replacing traditional ways of dealing with water. It is absolutely removing the local authority and the local culture in many ways and places. Working with local technology is extraordinarily important. And I just would add two things. One is that on the recycling in India, it's based on a terrible system of injustice, inequity, and poverty. And we need to understand what we in the global north or the west are doing in terms of that. There is more money paid from the global south to the global north in debt repayment than we send in aid and trade together to the global south. And until we deal with those justice issues, which is why I started off saying we have to look at the environment and the human justice issues together, we are never going to solve the problem of the global water crisis in the south, because poverty cannot be addressed until we deal with our part and our policies and what they have done to exacerbate the poverty in these communities.
Great. Over to this microphone.
Hi, I'm Violet Snow. I'm a freelancer from New Jersey. I'm just wondering what kind of technologies do exist for recycling gray water, especially in the West, and is there any activism directing it, trying to promote government incentives for developing these technologies?
Yeah, Marianne?
There's a growing movement. There's one in Oakland, California, actually called the Gray Water Gorillas, where they are challenging the kinds of plumbing regulations and public health regulations that are preventing widespread gray water use. But even in California, where they've had enabling legislation on the books for 16 years saying gray water is legal, because the local public health officer never had the comfort that the public health standards would be maintained in these unregulated gray water systems, permits were never given. So now in California, for the first time, they just amended their gray water regulations two or three weeks ago, saying you no longer need a permit to do a gray water project within your individual residential home. That's a far cry from any kind of national widespread implementation. And if you talk to Walmart, the officials at Walmart, they will say their number one public policy priority in the United States is a national gray water policy, because they can build facilities in Mexico that completely reuse every drop of water on site, but they can't build those facilities in the United States legally. So we need to address this at the national level and in Congress, and we need to get at the epidemiological issues that are being raised. What is safe? Clearly, gray water needs to be treated in some kind of on-site way. There's disagreement as to how much. Now, there are package systems available everywhere, in Germany and Australia. The problem is we can't bring them productively into the United States unless it's part of a pilot project or a green building exercise where you've gotten buy-in from the community to give it a permit. So we need to fix this. This is a policy issue here in the United States.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I would very much agree with that, and I'd lead you to a very interesting case study in Adelaide and Salisbury down in South Australia, where they have run out of water. There are two major cities, Adelaide and Salisbury, and they've taken very different approaches to what to do with having no more water from the Murray Darling, and I mean no water from the Murray Darling. So Adelaide is building two great big desalination plants, which are very, very expensive, very energy intensive, and create a poisonous brine when you put it back into the ocean. The place called Salisbury has a brilliant guy named Colin Pittman. Just look him up. Colin Pittman is an engineer who got the city to enter into a recycling gray water program, storm water catchment, rainwater catchment, which then he does not put through chemical technology so much as back into the earth, and he does it through a series of wetlands and lagoons, and he has greened the desert. And he has done an assessment of if Adelaide, which is bigger than Salisbury, were to reject its desal plants and take on his project, it would cost 70% less money and give them more adequate long-term supplies of water. So there are wonderful examples around the world where people are doing exciting things, including the whole concept of biomimetics, where we learn from nature how nature would handle drought and times of crisis.
And in Australia, they build new houses with what they call dual reticulation, which is double sets of pipes, one for potable water, one for the gray water. So in Adelaide, they've got developments.
A couple thoughts, Bob?
Visit the city of San Diego. It's known as toilet to tap. There is a psychological barrier. They've addressed some of the epidemiological problems, but fundamentally, we can do it. And they're using vegetation. They're using plants. So go to San Diego. There is innovation coming down line, and it's not expensive. In fact, it's a lot less expensive than what we're doing now.
Rob, you've probably been to San Diego a few times, haven't you?
I'm Rob Davis. I work for Voice of San Diego. Actually, public opinion polls show that the public in San Diego is starting to get away from the idea that somebody's flushing the toilet and then it's going to the tap.
So, but they're losing their hair.
So that perception is shifting. Anyway, my question really was for Mary Ann. With the shortage now in California, water managers at agencies throughout the state have been preaching water conservation, and the people have been responding so much, and you identify the problem, that people are conserving so much that they are laying people off, having hiring freezes, stopping spending on projects.
Revenue reductions.
So what's the answer to that?
Restructuring the way we charge for water. I spent a lot of years in Southern California. I worked for the Metropolitan Water District, and we had a program for conservation that was about, this was in 1992. We had $26 million a year that we spent on conservation. Last year, they weren't even spending that much, and they basically have scaled back. They are spending less money on conservation than they did back before this current drought. Why? Well, it's becoming a financial issue. And because the rates are not able to truly reflect what the cost of water is, and residents are resisting paying more for their water, we're locked in a rate structure that is not able to give the utilities what it costs to actually run the system. So we're advocating something called a budget-based rate structure, and Irvine Ranch Water District is your closest example of that. OTI, I think, is also another example of a budget-based rate structure, where the revenue requirement for the water utility is based on everybody being efficient. What is their water use aggregated if they're efficient? And then the revenue requirement is based on everybody being at that level. And then, of course, when they're higher than that efficient budget that they're given, it's a penalty. That penalty is cycled back into giving them conservation incentives to get them to be efficient. But the utility doesn't lose money. They actually make money on the penalties, plow them back into getting the customers down to that efficient level, which is the revenue requirement for the utility. So Irvine Ranch is one agency that's done it now for almost 15 years. But getting more communities around the country to do it has been a problem. I think there are only 28 of them that have that rate structure in the United States. So we need to promote that more heavily.
So here's the situation. Jay is fidgeting here for me to end the session, but what I want to do is something we haven't done yet, which is have all the questioners in a plenary get a chance to ask their questions quickly. We just have two left. We can just do it very quickly, and then we'll go. Oh, I'm sorry. We'll have to leave it at that then. All right. But if you could just ask just a quick question over there.
Okay. My name is Jordan Werfsbrock. I'm from the University of Colorado. Maude, you brought up the idea that water is a human right. And Marianne, you brought up the point that we can no longer think about water as something that's free. And I'm just curious about how those two ideas will be reconciled as we work towards solving this global resource issue.
Well, I think Marianne actually answered that to an extent. We're not talking about denying anybody the right to a certain level of water. It's what you're talking about is pricing.
Excessive
water. Right. And as some people call it block pricing, there's different ways of doing this. The state of Vermont just brought in some very interesting legislation I would get you to look at, and they declared their groundwater to be a public trust, and they put a priority on it, water for the watershed, water for equitable use for humans, for their people, their citizens, and for the ecosystem. And if you're going to use more than a certain amount, you have to get a permit. And that, you know, and you pay for the permit. So that's another way of looking at, perhaps commercial use, having a permitted system. The thing is, people always think, well, you must be against pricing if you're against privatization. And if the government or the local municipality is pricing for efficiency, for collection of this money to go back into infrastructure, I don't have a problem with it.
Still with a lifeline rate for the basic customer.
Yeah. Exactly.
I don't see there's a conflict at all.
But if that's the difference between that and a big company like Veolia or Suez coming in and they charge what they need to get to pay a profit to their shareholders, that we're opposed to. So I just make that distinction.
I think Chuck has a few announcements to make, but before he does, can we please... thank our guest speaker.